Check out my new book, Reach All Readers, at reachallreaders.com. When you pre-order, you'll get special access to my Science of Reading mini course. Learn more at reachallreaders.com. Hello, it's Anna Geiger from The Measured Mom, and in today's episode, I talk with Dee Dee Wills. You might know her from her website, Mrs. Wills Kindergarten. She's been operating there for a long time and has been selling on TPT for a long time as well. And a really neat thing about Dee Dee is that she was very much a balanced literacy guided reading teacher and teacher educator for a long time. But when she learned about the science of reading, she made a big switch, and she's open and honest about her journey and even was able to present at the Plain Talk conference this past winter. So today, she shares some highlights from her presentation at Plain Talk all about how to teach small groups in kindergarten. Here we go. Welcome, Dee Dee.
Hi, how are you?
Really good. So glad you're here.
I am glad to be here.
Dee Dee was actually instrumental in my journey coming into the science of reading. I've shared before on this podcast how when I first learned that Emily Hanford's article, The Loss for Words, was throwing punches at 3Qing, I felt pretty upset by that. And I went into a Facebook group asking, say, hey, I know a lot of you, you know, do the same thing I do. You teach the idea of guided reading with leveled books. You know, how would you react to this article? And I was really surprised that people came out saying, yeah, actually, she's right. And here's why. And here's what you should read. And that really surprised me because that's not what I was expecting. I was expecting people to show me exactly how to break down her argument. But nobody did that. Yeah. And you were one of the people that chimed in there and listed a lot of books for me to read. And that was, I didn't know you personally at the time, but that was really eye-opening for me because of all the success that you've had sharing resources online. And then you said, finding out that MSV, 3Qing, is bad for kids is like finding out that your only child is a serial killer. And I've shared that before, and people think that sounds a little over the top, but people who know, they know that it really does feel like that.
Yeah.
It was just really tough. So hearing that from someone like you really, really helped a lot. And way back when I was learning about the science of reading, I did reach out to a lot of people. You were one of them, and said, hey, can you just talk to me on a Google chat? Because I'm really struggling with some of these things. And that was super helpful. So, but you weren't always there. So can you go back in time and talk to us about how you got into teaching and what happened over time to shift your understanding?
To shift it. Well, I would love to say that I was always there, but I wasn't always there. You know, when I first started teaching, I got hired at San Diego Unified School District, where I taught as a first-year teacher. Along out of 44 teachers, there were 40 of us that were first-year teachers, because this was a state kind of watched school. It was at the risk of being taken over by the state because of low performing. So when we were all hired, they completely moved kind of veteran teachers out and brought new teachers in because we all didn't know any better. And so we spent a lot of time receiving additional training. So we had experts coming in from all over the world, like literally all over the world, to teach us about guided reading. Mm-hmm. And so we had 3 hours of professional development every week on guided reading. Mm-hmm. And so we used that approach with a group of students who were 96% second language learners, 100% free and reduced lunch, you know, the students who were the most at risk students. And we saw growth at the end of the first year. I taught second grade at the time. And then at the end of the second grade year, we also saw growth. And so, you know, that was, I'm doing air quotes, that was proof that guided reading worked to me and to everybody else at the time. Now, this is early 2000s. And then we moved out of state. So I taught in Missouri and kept doing the same type of practices. Nobody was really using a differentiated approach to instruction. So we had a lot of students who were falling through the cracks. So I started doing guided reading. I saw gains, again, air quotes here, with my students. So they asked me to become the instructional coach after being there for a couple of years. So this is kind of a long story, and I know that you're probably sitting comfortably in your chair, but they sent me for an additional 2 years of training on something called Guided Reading Plus, which was a Linda Dorn, Carla Sofus kind of approach. And so, yes, I did that again and taught all of my teachers about the joys of balanced literacy and specifically guided reading. I missed the classroom, went back into the classroom and used guided reading in my own classroom. But here's something that I really noticed is that, you know, when you start off the year, you see those 4 to 5 students in your intensive intervention group. You know, they are slow to learn. They are needing lots and lots of practice, and you meet with them every single day. And I have this kind of mental image of me, like, grabbing them by the shirt and pulling them through kindergarten, right? Like, really mm-hmm. sitting with them. They're working really hard. I'm working really hard. By the time we get to the end of the year, then they are just about at grade level, and I send them off to first grade. And then all of a sudden, I see them going down the hall in first grade to the intervention room and the second mm-hmm. grade, same students, mm-hmm. intervention. I mean, mm-hmm. year after year after year of them continuing to have this reading thing be elusive. And not only just that 4 to 5 students, it was the group that's a little bit higher than them, but not quite at grade level. Same type of thing. And when we started to see the test results in our schools, specifically the one in San Diego, because I did keep in touch with people, and then in Missouri, the same thing happened. We saw initial growth and then a leveling off, where we were seeing what statistically we're hearing even now, with about 40% of our fourth graders not reading at grade level. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was thinking, well, that's just the way that it is, right? Mm-hmm. 40% of the population aren't going to be proficient readers. I carried on my day in this way, right? I carried on the years after years of me really being an advocate for balanced literacy, thinking that's just the way that it is. And then one of the things that I do as I do these webinars, and somebody asked me, when I asked what should my next webinar be about, they said, would you tell us how you teach high frequency words or sight words? And I said, yes, I will do that. And so as I sat there and thought about it, I thought, well, how do I teach them? And then I realized I didn't teach them. I mm-hmm. assigned them mm-hmm. and then we practiced them, but I never really explicitly taught them. So I went with my friend Google on a rabbit hole and led me ultimately to Emily Hanford's I went on to Reading Rockets really first, and then eventually made it to Emily Hanford's podcast. And it was a really painful mm-hmm. period, because not because I was wrong, and I'm just getting kind of teary thinking about mm-hmm. it, but I was thinking of those students that were in my kindergarten class, that were in my first grade class, who year after year learned that they were not successful. And I believed, and those who worked with them believed, that they just weren't going to be successful, and this is just the way that it was. Mm-hmm. And I know how that carries on to adulthood, right? So I had a lot of guilt, but as soon as I started to really dig into it, I had so many aha moments that I knew I couldn't go back. So I kind of went public with the way that I thought this, and now I don't. One, hopefully encouraging people who were in the same shoes as I am to say, yeah, we can shift our thinking. And really, we want to make sure that we're constantly shifting our thinking. One thing that Emily Hanford said to me and a group of other people was that we want to always remain humble and curious. Mm-hmm. And I hope that, you know, if I were to ever get a tattoo, I don't have one, but if I ever were, I feel like that would be one that I would want to get. Because as an educator, everybody should be remaining humble and curious, because the moment we think we know everything, we're going to hear something different that's going to shift our thinking, hopefully a little bit, and make our instruction a little more effective. So that's my journey.
Yeah. And I love that you're willing to be open about it. I just think that's so important, because it's easy to pretend that we've known all along. And yeah. that certainly makes us look better. But it's people really need to know the struggles yes. that we've had, and so that they can make those changes too. But there are just so many things that are hard to wrestle with. And one of those would be small groups. And you recently presented at Plain Talk, which is incredibly impressive. Everybody, most people listening know about Plain Talk. It's one of the big science of reading conferences every year down in Louisiana. And you talked about small groups. So I'd like to talk today about maybe the difference between small group guided reading lessons versus more strategic small group lessons, and how that looks in a classroom.
Right. You know, I mean, going to Plain Talk was certainly, I had a little bit of an imposter syndrome, because I'm there with a lot of thought leaders, you know, researchers. Although I'm a researcher, I research what other researchers have done.
Yeah,
right? I'm not actually conducting the studies myself, right? But what I found was I could speak to the practitioner part of it. And so that was, you know, something that I think I've always been able to do. And I was really glad that I had the opportunity. And so when talking about small group, you know, the first thing that we want to make sure that we have really clear is how we want to get away from that MSV model. Because for a lot of teachers, what I'm hearing when I go out and speak at different conferences or, you know, in other groups is, yes, we're doing a science of reading approach to instruction as our core curriculum, but when it comes to small group, they're still using level texts. And so there's a disconnect there for that. And I was just recently in a conference in Chicago, and there was a teacher attending a session that wasn't on the small group instruction, but she was really having a hard time seeing, well, what is wrong with MSV at those earliest levels? Mm-hmm. Why can't we stay with level text and let them go into this other type of instruction later on? And so when I broke down why that is an issue, she was like, now it makes sense. So if you would like for me to kind of talk a little bit about that, I can. So, you know, when we talk about level text, and I'm going to go to the kindergarten level, we really start with these super predictable texts that are, you know, I like the horse, I like the, you know, donkey, I like the whatever, and the pictures really carry all those meanings. And so if a student's really good at holding some oral language in their head, they can find that pattern, that sentence pattern, and it looks like they're reading. And so although that is, you know, obviously we want to have students exposed to those high frequency words, but if they're only memorizing those and not really reading them or looking all the way through, that becomes very problematic. So, you know, the example that I just gave is a simple example of a text, but when we get to maybe the end of first grade, or maybe perhaps even the end of kindergarten, depending on the reader, you know, you can have a text that has words in there the student doesn't know, maybe context words, right? And if they make a few miscues on those and the meaning is no longer carried with the picture, then you see how comprehension breaks down. So one example, I'm going to go ahead and look at my example for my slides because I can't remember everything by heart. But one example in a level text, the text says deep inside of the ear is a membrane called an eardrum. And if a student reads it, deep inside the ear is a memory called an eardrum, you can see how meaning starts to break down. And within several sentences, you can see where these misconceptions are happening. Students are guessing, and now all of a sudden comprehension becomes an issue. So we really want to make sure right from the very beginning that we can see truly what are the students, what skills does the students have under their belt in the phonics world, the phonics and phonemic awareness world, so that we can make sure that we don't move ahead before they're ready, right? We don't want to move ahead before they have those skills, you know, grounded in that alphabetic principle, right? So we want to make sure that they really have all of their letters and sounds, that they can blend and segment, so that when they come to a word like membrane, they can look all the way through there and say, well, no, memory doesn't make sense because I don't see, I don't hear the sound of B or an R really, you know, next to the membrane part, right? So we don't have the N sound in there. So all of those things, we definitely use meaning as a way to check that decoding part, but we don't use it as that first line of defense, that guessing. And we think about balanced literacy, you know, that activity called Guess the Covered Word.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I had the book.
I mean, I love that activity. It was so much fun. I mean, we're just guessing, but then I think about it, really, we were guessing, looking at that first letter and maybe a couple more, but not really going all the way through. And the other part that is a problem with those level text is we're putting words in front of them that they don't have the phonic skills yet to decode. So there's that controlled text isn't there. So they were constantly asking, guess this word, guess this word, guess this word. And boy, if I want to have somebody practice a skill, if I'm going to be like a pole vaulter, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be a pole vaulter. But if I was going to be a pole vaulter, there would be no reason for me to practice throwing a football. That's not going to help me, right? And that's kind of what happened in small group. We did this little thing called word work, which feels like phonics-based, and it feels like, you know, we're doing phonemic awareness practice. And then we say, now you're going to read this book, and you may or may not basically encounter this phonic skill or this pattern. So, you know, Godspeed, good luck to you, right? That's kind of what happened in level text. So we really want to make sure we have that controlled text. So that's where decodable texts come in. Yes. So that is sort of kind of why that's important. And then your question of what is it, how does it look different, is that we're not using level text. We're using more of a controlled text that matches what the student's skills are at that time and kind of what they're requiring. Plus those skills, that text really matches closer to an independent level than that
instructional
that
level
that we done before, right? Yeah. So yeah, so that yeah, the instructional level. So it's closer to independent than it is to that previously learned instructional level.
Yeah, and I think also when I think about guided reading model lessons, it's kind of the phonics is the afterthought at the end of the lesson, right? So at the end, if you have time, you do some word work. Whereas probably these strategic groups, that kind of, especially in the primary grades, that leads the way, right? We're focusing here on our word level skills and then we're applying it versus, oh, by the way, here's some word level work we could do if we have time.
And we never have time, right? So we always finish the cruise account. We're like, okay, well, we'll try to get it next week, and we don't. So yeah, there's never enough time. So we always want to front load that with these more structured texts as well. And so, you know, that's part of it is the materials that we use are going to be different. But also the way that we structure those groups are going to be a little bit different as well. So, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm constantly reading and learning more things. So there's a really good chance if you ask me to come back and talk to you about this a year from now, that I might tell you something different. But this is where I am right now in my understanding is that not every student needs to have a 30-minute level text or guided reading or decodable text lesson. They don't all need to have a book lesson. Some students need strategy lessons. So I might pull a group of students who just need letter work, right? So they might just need identifying letter, handwriting that letter, and then producing the sound that goes with it. So we want to do all three of those things at the same time because we know that the way that the brain works is that they're all interconnected. And when you practice all three of those together, it helps anchor those letters to the sounds. And then that fine motor practice of handwriting, it also helps anchor that as well. So we want to include that in our strategy group. So if I had a strategy group that was letters and sounds, the letter sound strategy group, I would meet with them for 5 to 7 minutes and we would work on that strategy and would just be working on encoding, decoding, and recognizing. Okay, so the way that it might work is that I want to think about what my core curriculum looks like, right? Because I want to make sure that I'm delivering instruction that matches what is, if your core curriculum is good, I should just say that. If your core curriculum is good, then you want to make sure that it matches. So in the core curriculum, we are constantly seeing the letter, saying the letter, saying the sound. We are constantly, I mean, on an everyday basis, we are hearing the sound, saying the letter that represents that sound, and then hearing the sound and writing the letter that represents that sound. So those are things that are happening on a daily basis. And we want to make sure that we're mirroring that because we don't want to give them a completely different type of instruction because that sort of falls into, you know, I always, so this is my analogy that I use, but if I'm going to teach somebody something, I want to make sure I deliver the instruction the same way in so that I can get the same output back, right? So that memory needs to be tracked consistently in for a student so it can be pulled out consistently for the student. So I always think about if I'm going to plant a garden and I have a hoe and I'm going to get my garden ready to put that seed in, I take that hoe and I'm going to hoe a row. And it doesn't make sense for me to go all over the garden hoeing rows when I need to make sure that I'm getting that little trough, I'm doing this with my hands, a little trough deep enough to drop the seed in. So I don't want to go all over the garden doing it. I want to go over the same space again and again and again so that I can build that pathway or neural pathway is the same way of thinking about it. So if I'm doing that in my whole group instruction, I want to make sure that I'm duplicating that in my small group instruction so that students can retrieve that memory, right?
So are you saying like using the same kind of lesson routines? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, I'm talking about the same routines. So instead of maybe using slide decks, which I do, PowerPoint slide decks, maybe I'm using letter cards. I could still use the slide decks if that's what I have. It's easy for me, but I can also do slide little cards, right? So they can see those and they can just say, you know, to make the path of motion with their arm, right? T says T, and then we do another one, and B says B, and all of those sounds. So we'll warm up with that. So that's going to be something that I want to make sure that I keep in there. And we want to stack that deck for student success. So if I'm meeting with my students who, you know, in the previous years I would identify as my intervention group, they may not know a lot of letters and sounds. They might know five letters and sounds, right? So I want to make sure I include those five. And then I add the additional ones that we're going to be practicing at this moment in time so that we have success, 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 struggle, struggle, success, success, right? So we want to have lots of successes for them. I've also been learning a lot about like cognitive load theory. And so we don't want to give them struggle, 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 because they're not going to hold on to those skills. We really shouldn't be introducing more than four at one time that they don't have solid already. So we want to make sure that we're giving them a lot of reinforced things that they already may have in their long-term memory, and then the things that we're putting into their short-term memory with enough exposures to move over into their long-term memory. So the materials that we're going to use are going to be the similar type of materials, but the ones we're going to select are going to be really tailored to the students that we have in front of us so that we can, you know, give them lots of chance for success. And again, they might have it in their working memory, but they may not have it in their long-term memory, or they might have in their short-term memory. So we want to make sure that we give them lots of exposures to move that over.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that you've described what you would do with a group that's still struggling with letters and sounds. What would be another group you might have?
Well, you know, you'll have students, depending on the time of year, those students might also, you know, 6 months later, might be struggling with blending and segmenting. So we would do the same type of a thing. So I would give them, you know, the same type of skills. So I'm going to show them a CVC word, and we're going to practice tapping and blending it. I'm going to tell them a CVC word. They're going to practice spelling it and writing it. So same type of thing. After we've done that kind of warm up, whether it's letters, segmenting, blending, segmenting and blending would be the same group. Then we would do... you know, we could do some more handwriting activities. We could play a game so that we're really seeing those again and again. We want to make it highly engaging. After 4 to 5 minutes, off you go. You're back to your, you know, student centers. And then, so I typically would have two strategy groups during a day's small group period. And then two, I was going to say level text, structured literacy, like a decodable text that I would have. Okay. And so for that group, we would... again, provide the same type of instruction. They're going to see, we're going to do some phonemic awareness activities where we're blending and segmenting. We're going to be looking at words that they can, that are within that scope that they're practicing. If it's CVC words, if it's with digraphs, right, we're going to practice those words where they're blending across the line, nine words within that little kind of family of what we're working on. And then they'll do some dictation along with sentence dictation. So we just want to make sure that we're giving them both that in and out kind of type of instruction. And then we would go into using a decodable text. So now that is something that, you know, there's a lot of different discussion about what decodable text should look like. When Deanna and I wrote our decodable text, we really wanted to make sure that we got away from anything that looked like level text. So we removed a lot of pictures from the book. We have a picture on the cover, and then each of the text pages, we don't really have any pictures at all. The only pictures we might have would be like a little rebus for a story where that's needed to carry the story. Okay. I know a lot of other people will put that in an illustration, which I think is, there's no problem with that, but we just wanted to really have ours be removed from that possibility, because sometimes the devil's in the details. Sometimes we just lean into that, and sometimes it's really hard to know what students are doing or not doing, right? So that rebus would be in there, and students would have a highly decodable text. Most of our books are 70%+ decodable. Okay. So they would be practicing that C skill again and again. If we're now working with a group that has a silent E, they're going to be seeing CVC words and silent E words, because we want to make sure that we're not just doing the skill of the week, because students really figure that out quickly, don't they? Oh, these are all short A sounds, or these are all short I sounds. So then they overgeneralize that. So we want to make sure that they're not only just practicing this particular activity, but all of those previously learned skills that they've had. So we want to make sure that we include those into the text as well. And then the students will be able to take that book or that text home to practice, or perhaps maybe with a partner in the classroom, so that they'll have some additional exposures. But, you know, also before we start to actually start to read the book, we're going to also orthographically map any of those high frequency words that they need to have a refresher on or might be new to them. Maybe we needed those words in the text to carry the story, but they haven't been done as the whole group. So we'll go ahead and include that instruction right then and there. But again, the same idea of what we do for, you know, our small group or for our strategy groups, we don't want to throw a whole bunch of words at them. You know, here's 72 words that we're going to orthographically map. We're going to keep it to a short number, 3 to 4, so that that working memory isn't just overloaded. So mm-hmm. same kind of idea. And that's really kind of the crux of that decodable text. We do ask some comprehension questions. But as you know, comprehension in a decodable text it's tough. It's tough to have really deep conversations about a book that doesn't have the text complexity that matches their oral language, right? So mm-hmm. in kindergarten, their oral language far exceeds their decodable language. So really, we do all of our comprehension, most of our comprehension work through a read aloud activity. So where I'm doing the coding and the students are doing a lot of the thinking work. So that's building their oral language and their ability to interact with the text in a deep way. But we also want to ask a few questions on those decodable texts to make sure, you know, did they get that? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's times when I'll ask questions. Some of them are right there in the text, like what was the color of the, you know, the sled? It was red. You know, what was the name of the dog? It was Ted or something. Now I'm going to do all the words that rhyme. You know, it might be something along those lines, or it could be more of an inferential. So why do you think the dog took the blah, 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 mm-hmm. right? And so, and if you were in that situation, how would you get the blah, blah, blah back, right? So something that's asking them to think beyond the text, but they have to get the big idea of the text in order to get there.
Yeah, and even if we might not be able to ask real deep questions, there are things we can do, like teaching them to answer in a complete sentence, you know, start with the end of my question. And so there is a lot we can do with oral language, even though, like you said, those texts aren't typically written for deep thinking.
Yes.
So overall, you're talking about starting with a lesson for everyone. Yes. And then differentiating based on need. Do you find that there's a way to challenge the kids who are beyond what you're teaching in the core lesson? Here's my impression. You can tell me if I'm wrong. But my impression is a lot of teachers do this model, but what they end up saying, yeah, we meet the needs of everybody, but then what ends up happening is there isn't time to challenge the kids who are beyond the scope and sequence. What is your thought on that?
Well, I think you do need to challenge the students beyond scope and sequence. You know, sometimes those are students that learn in spite of us, right? You're like, those are students who are like, you just got to get out of their way. However, what we do know is that although their reading abilities might be really high, oftentimes their spelling abilities don't match that. And over time, that becomes problematic for them as well when they just keep moving on and on and on and on versus really making sure that they understand that phonic skill and how to spell that as well. So yeah, you could meet with your higher group. They're not going to need as much instruction as your students who need multiple exposures to master a skill. But meeting with your higher group once a week to do a decodable text that's above what you're doing as a whole group instruction, is a really good idea. You know, if you have in kindergarten, you have students who come in who are reading, you know, at a first grade level, they're probably not spelling at a first grade level. So that's kind of where you can begin with that group, is to say, okay, they're reading really well, but when I look at their writing, I'm noticing that that's not transferring to their writing. So that might be a place for me to pull them into a small group. And again, the way that the lessons are structured is that we're, you know, not just reading, we're also spelling with that dictation part of it. And also, you know, conventions are something that's, you know, it's a little slower for students to learn. So you have a chance to practice that as well. You know, I've always believed, and I don't know where I heard this quote, but I know I didn't make it up myself, but every student deserves a year of growth. So if you have a student coming in at a first grade level, they still deserve a year of growth.
Yeah.
One, because that's our job. But two, as a parent, we don't want them to think that they've come and wasted a year, or that we want parents to think, oh, maybe they need to skip a grade, because I think that's really dangerous for when we think about all of the skills they have to master. Sometimes they're really strong in just one, and skipping a grade at those early grades is, I don't want to say dangerous, but I think it can be, it can't always, it's a not always beneficial for them to do that. Maybe their math skills aren't there. Their writing skills might be there. Maybe their maturity level isn't there. Or maybe if, you know, they are, you know, do we want them to be the last person in their high school to get their driver's license or graduate when they're 15?
Oh, yes.
You know, those are things that we don't always think about as parents when they're 5 and 6. But, you know, later on in life, you know, sometimes it doesn't set them up to be necessarily a leader because of the difference in maturity levels. So, you know, keeping them challenged within the grade level, I think, is our responsibility as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So basically the takeaway is if you're going to teach phonics with your whole group, it is required pretty much that you follow up with some small group instruction because, of course, they're not all going to be learning it at the same pace. Some kids are actually going to be beyond your scope and sequence and may need support in other ways, including spelling, but also challenging them with skills beyond the scope and sequence or farther along, I should say. And then that those groups are going to change based on mastery, right? So if someone is in that alphabet group, but they're picking those up pretty fast, then they're going to need to move into a different group.
Absolutely.
Do you think that this is overwhelming for teachers? Like this idea of, well, what groups do I pull and how do I decide who's in them? Like any practical tips for working through that?
Yes. So, you know, while I'm doing whole group lessons, now, just to be clear, I go in and work with classrooms. I don't have my own classroom now, but when I go in and I work in with classrooms now, while I'm doing whole group, I keep a clipboard so that as I am showing slides, I'm kid watching the entire, and you can't watch 22 kids at one time, but I'm kid watching at the same time. I might be looking at these 4 students today and those 4 students, and I'm just watching to see how quickly are they responding? Is there automaticity mastery there, or are they just kind of lagging behind and letting other students kind of carry it? There's nothing wrong with that, but that just tells me they don't have mastery. Or that could be one of the problems. They also could be doing pencil erasers, right? So that could be also the issue. But while I'm also doing dictation, I'm noticing, so I'm looking for 4 pieces of information while I'm doing that whole group. I'm looking to see if they see the letter, can they name it? If they see the letter, can they tell me the sound that it makes most frequently? If they hear the sound, can they tell me the letter that represents that sound? And can they write that sound with the right path of motion, right? So those are the 4 pieces of information that I'm constantly gathering on this clipboard. I just have this table. It's nothing fancy, but I just code it. So like I is for identify, E is for encoding, D is for decoding, and F is for formation. So I just write down as I notice, oh, I'm noticing that this group of students are having trouble with the M sound, right? And letter formation for M, because they're all McDonald M's, which we don't want to even, no, we're not going to McDonald's M. But I'm noticing that. So that's telling me I can pull them for a quick letter group. Now, some students might need to see me 3 times and be like, I'm good to go. Like I've gotten them straightened out. Or other students are going to need to be in that group a little longer. So it's very flexible. And I think that, I know we've always talked about flexible grouping, but sometimes we want to have them be in nice, neat groups so we can call the blue group or the red group. And I think that's kind of limiting for us when we put them in a group and leave them there because they should be moving in and out of that group very flexibly, right? So what I do is I say, can I see so-and-so? So, you know, I just call their names and they come to my table. I don't name them the hamsters or the guinea pigs or anything like that, because you might be a guinea pig this week, but next week you might be a fox. I don't know. And so keeping those groups really flexible, but when you have it all on one table, so you see, so you'll have the students' names across the top of the table and then the letters down the side of the table. And then it's like graph paper. You can really quickly go through and see the letter P, who needs that letter. You see which letters they need. And so that's a really easy way for you to say, this is my small group, maybe for this week. I'm going to pull these students for this week. Just don't be afraid to move students in and out. You know, you may have your letter strategy group. You might have 2 different letter strategy groups. You have the students who are further along in the alphabet, and you have students who are still learning several letters and sounds. So you might have several different alphabet groups, especially at the beginning of the year. You'll have more alphabet groups than you'll have blending and segmenting groups.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Before we kind of close off, maybe you could give us just a little overview of the whole literacy or reading block. Like, about how much time would you spend in each area, like that whole group lesson? How much time might you, And obviously it changes on situation, but just in general, sure. what might be the time for the small groups and then for the language comprehension piece that you mentioned earlier?
Sure. So the whole group, you know, science of reading lesson, that's about 40 minutes when you include the phonics instruction and the high frequency word mapping and that sort of thing. So that's a 30 to 40 minute kind of drill activity. Very explicit. You know, yes, we love to explore things, but we know that's not the best way for them to get that information. So it should be very quick. And one thing that teachers tend to get a little bit bogged down with that whole group instruction is they're wanting their whole group to be with them. So they don't move on to the next slide until everybody has answered the first slide, right? And what we know is that there's going to be some students who are just going to be not quite there yet. If you structure those lessons well, and that's a whole nother time we could talk about it, but where first they're attempting and then they're verifying the work. So they're attempting and verifying. The students who don't know what's happening, they may not be able to attempt well, but when they verify, they're still practicing that skill. But you'll want to keep pace with about 60% of your class. So 60% of your class is with you, then you're on the right pace. Mm-hmm. If you have only 20%, you're going too fast. If you have 100%, you're going too slow. So you'll just want to keep pace with about 60% of your class with those lessons. And then small group, you know, about 40 minutes a day for small group instruction would be about the minimum. The problem is what are the rest of the students doing? Mm-hmm. That's the big thing. You don't want to have the bulk of the students doing work that's not allowing them to practice skills that they need. So you have to be very good at differentiating your center so that they're actually working the entire time and engaged in skills that they need to overlearn to work on mastery. Mm-hmm. So depending on how well you feel about your center time, that's a whole nother time that we could talk about that as well. But about 40 minutes for your small group instruction. Reading comprehension is about 20 minutes. It's teachers doing a read aloud. 5 days is what we do, a close reading, very similar to the way Doug Fisher talks about his close reading, where we're re-engaging with the same text over 5 days to dig deeper. There's a ton of student conversation taking place during that time where the students are doing the meaning making with, you know, the more knowing adult to ask questions. And you could do some writing response in that period of time, but really 15 to 20 minutes for that whole group read aloud, interactive read aloud of time. And then writing instruction is also really important. So you'll want to have about 40 minutes for writing instruction, and that's for that composing part of it. And then the last part is your handwriting instruction. So you want to make sure you're having 5 minutes a day of handwriting instruction that's very explicit. Not handwriting practice, but instruction. So this was a statistic I really found surprising, is that students need 5 minutes a day, kindergarten, first grade, every day through those 2 years in order to really build handwriting fluency. Yeah, I mean, that's just another thing that we have to make time for. Mm-hmm. But in small group and during dictation, we can add that practice part of it, right? But that instruction needs to be really explicit. 5 minutes a day, it doesn't have to be a lot. It's better to do 5 minutes each day than one 25-minute lesson a week. Mm-hmm. So 5 minutes each day working on handwriting fluency, making sure that we're starting on the right place of the page. We have so many first graders that are starting at the bottom, second graders, third graders mm-hmm. starting at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big problem when it comes to fluency, and really takes a toll by the time they get to fourth grade. So we want to make sure that we're including those parts. So I think I covered all of those.
Yes, yes. Great job. Okay. Great job. So Okay. Can you talk to us a little bit here at the end about where your place online and where people can find you, and maybe a little bit about the Educator Summit?
Sure. I am at Mrs. Wills Kindergarten. You know, if I could talk to my 2010 Dee Wills, I would have said, you know what, you might go beyond kindergarten with your blog. But, you know, she didn't listen to me then. But, you know, Mrs. Wills Kindergarten on Teachers Pay Teachers and on my social media, or I should say Instagram, I'm Dee Wills. And then on Facebook, I'm also Mrs. Wills Kindergarten. Someday I'm going to be a TikToker. I have a TikTok, a very sad little TikTok channel that gets ignored. So I haven't done much with that. But yeah, that's where you can find me. And then the Educator Summit is a online virtual training conference that my husband and I started several years ago. And we've had some amazing people, including you. Thank you so much for being part of that over the last 3 years. We are no longer the owners of that. We have sold that company, but I'm still on as an advisory. So finding people that, and you've met the new owner, he's completely lovely. But it allows teachers to watch content online on demand for 90 days. So we have some amazing subject matter experts on there, as well as some inspirational keynotes. But we're really content driven. So we're not the, you know, the rah, 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 but it's very entertaining on top of informational. So we've had, each summit's had over 6,000 people, and this year I think it's going to double. So we're really excited about that. It means that we have the same people returning. It means that, to me, it means that people are finding value there, and that it's something that they are looking forward to. So, yeah, that's going to be starting on June 1st this year.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It was, as always, a pleasure to talk to you and see you and to hear all these things explained for teachers. We really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much. I can't wait for your book.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for listening. You can find the show notes at themeasuredmom.com/episode161. Talk to you next time.
That's all for this episode of Triple R Teaching. For more educational resources, visit Anna at her home base, themeasuredmom.com, and join our teaching community. We look forward to helping you reflect, refine, and recharge on the next episode of Triple R Teaching.